Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome. This is session 122 with Father Robert Spitzer, how to make a convincing case for the pro-life movement, especially for young people. My name is Dana Cusso, and I'm the San Fernando Regional Coordinator for the ORE in the Office of Religious Education in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Before we begin, I would like to ask if everyone hasn't already, please silence your cell phones, and we ask that no audio or videotaping take place during this workshop. Thank you. Now let us pray. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen. Loving God, your heart is ever drawn near to those who cry out to you. Open our ears to hear their plea and move our hearts to act justly and with humility. Break the chains of all who are captive, whether in body, mind, or spirit. Reunite those who have been separated. And through your Son, Jesus, may all that we say and do bear fruit in abundance. We ask this through the same Jesus, our Lord. Amen. Amen. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. It is my honor this morning to introduce to you Father Robert Spitzer. Father Spitzer is a Jesuit priest, scholar, teacher, professor, author, theologian, and philosopher. Just a few things. He is currently president of the Magis Center at Christ Cathedral in Orange County and the president of the Spitzer Center. He was formerly the president of Gonzaga University from 1998 to 2009.
No,
and has published 11 books, the most recent ones, The Soul's Upward Yearning, Clues to Our Transcendent Nature from Experience and Reason from Ignatius Press, and one of his very popular books, New Proofs of the Existence of God from Physics and Philosophy from Erdmann's. And all of these can, and more, much more, can be found in his booth 100 in the exhibit hall. He's also published many scholarly articles for which he has won awards. Father Spitzer gives over 90 public presentations in the United States and around the world per year and appears on television and radio, where many of you have already seen him many times. He has appeared on Larry King Show, where he debated Stephen Hawking, The Today Show, The History Channel, PBS, and one of my favorite shows on EWTN, where Faith Meets Reason, Father Spitzer's Universe. Ladies and gentlemen, Father Robert Spitzer.
Thank you, Dana. Thank you so much. No lip on this. Very funny. Very good. Thank you. Sorry. The podium without a lip. Sorry. It's wonderful to be with all of you, and an honor that you would come to listen to this talk on making a convincing case for the pro-life movement. I just wanted to begin with talking about a few resources that are available on this issue, and then I'm going to talk about a couple of books in a second. The first thing is, if you want the full text of this article, I published it in the Proceedings of the University Faculty for Life last year. And so I would just send it to you by email. Just send me an email, or actually send the Magis Center an email. Just here it is, susan@magiscenter.com. susan@magiscenter.com. And we'll go ahead and send you the full text of this article, as well as all the PowerPoints that I'll be using today. Secondly, if you are interested in getting a more, the whole thing, and not just, the 25-page article, but you want the whole first part of the talk, here is a book called Healing the Culture from Ignatius Press, available in booth 100 there, easy booth to remember, Healing the Culture. Second part of the talk will be on the 10 Universal Principles. And that's, again, available down there, thin book, and available at the booth 100 as well. If you're going really want to use this in a high school, we have tested it very, very well in high schools all over the country. And you can just go to healingtheculture.com, where they have some curricula there. And also, if you click on principlesandchoices.com, that's the actual high school curriculum that you can implement in your school if you want to. Camille Pauly runs the healingtheculture.com, and we co-founded it together about 15, well, actually now maybe 20 years ago. So it's clicking along really well. That's some resources, and I'm going to go through these at the end just in case your curiosity is piqued by the end of the presentation. Let me move on to some statistics. HealingTheCulture.com has beta tested this in several high schools. And the interesting thing is, if you look at point number one, what we've done is we've done the principles first without application to pro-life issues. So just, you know, giving the kids the actual seven principles that I'll be talking about today. And those principles, as we go through it, the kids actually respond very positively. They have no qualms with the principles at all. So it really speaks to their hearts, speaks to their minds. Then if you look at that second statistic, this is just an amazing statistic. Across the board, high schools, I mean, we're talking about blue states, red states, right across the board. Basically, in a Catholic high school, about 50 to 51% start off as pro-life. So that means about 50% are pro-abortion. This is in a Catholic high school, I know, but it's true. 50% start off as pro-abortion right away. After the presentation of all the points that I'll be making today during the talk, and I'm going to be going through them briefly and more succinctly than obviously you would do in a high school class where there'd be discussion and you know all kinds of exercises to help people appropriate the principles and their application. But after we've applied them to the pro-life thing, 86% became pro-life. So it moved from 50% to 86%. So if you look at the differential, that means that we took, of the whole population that started off pro-abortion, we changed the minds of 71% of them. We changed the minds and hearts of 71% of them. These principles work. I'm going to go through them with you, give you a sense of how they work in a second. But it absolutely, across the board, blue states, red states, it works for the kids. So let's go to the very quickly here to, you know, what's our strategy in doing this? The first thing is you have to basically change the hearts of the kids first. And not just the kids, the adults, the hardened adults. You have to change the heart first. Then you go for the mind. So we're going to talk a little bit about the first step of changing the heart in the first part of the talk. I'm going to go through it quite briefly by comparison to what we do. That's the book Healing the Culture. But if you want the full text of this with all the footnotes to all the principles and all the sources and everything that I'll be talking about, send an email to susan@modjacenter.com. You can get it all for free. Here's the quick uptake. When you're changing the heart of somebody, you basically have to change their interior motivational structure. And you have to do it in a self-motivated way. You can't impose anything on people, right? The minute you try and say you have to, you ought to, you should, you can just feel the resistance coming across the room right at you through the eyes of these kids. They're just not gonna do it. So what we need to do is get them to want to do it by a self-motivational way. Now, I know this sounds odd, but really, this goes all the way back to the time of St. Augustine's Confessions. And it goes all the way through St. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote that treatise on happiness, right? Right in the middle, you know, the transition point of the Summa Theologica. And there's a very good reason that he did this. And then, of course, if we go into it today, we can see it in contemporary psychology. We can see it in Abraham Maslow's model. We can also see it in the models of Erik Erikson. We can see it in the moral philosopher and psychologist Carlson. We can also see it in feminist interpretation, if I might put it that way, of Carol Gilligan, who basically redid the moral, psychological levels. We can see it in Fowler's levels of faith. It's just everywhere present. So it really has a good history. And the good history is begin with happiness for one very simple reason. Aristotle put it to us a long time ago, right? Happiness is the one thing you can choose for itself. Everything else, said Aristotle, is chosen for the sake of happiness. You want to get to the interior motivational structure, says Aristotle. You want to get to the heart of somebody? Start talking about happiness. Everybody perks up because people really do have a sense of unhappiness. Our kids have a sense of unhappiness in this culture of plenty. They have a sense of unhappiness, and we can move them beyond that unhappiness with really fairly easily, relatively easily. Let me just go to, you know, these four levels. I'm not going to really go into it in very much depth right now. You can get it in the article, free of by writing to Susan at MontaCenter.com. What I want to do is get to the principal area of the identity shift. See, there are four levels of happiness, very briefly. The first level is materialistic happiness and sensual pleasure happiness, right? So sensuality and materiality make you happy. They do on a certain very basic level. They do. So number two, ego-comparative happiness. This is the bane of our culture. This is what we have to worry about the most. So we're going to have to talk, a little bit about this, happiness on the level of egocentricity, of ego-comparative satisfactions, and I'll get into it in just a moment. The third level of happiness is contributive happiness. Everybody wants their life to make a difference. To make a difference to their families, ultimately. Now, of course, you say, well, I have a teenage kid right now, and he could care less about making any difference to anybody. He's really self-involved. Do not be deceived. Of course, they might roll their eyes at you, but they're still listening, and I got the statistics to guarantee it. They are listening. The point, of course, is appearances are deceiving. Don't try and read their impressions. They could just as easily be manipulating you as listening to you, or both. The second, the third area then is this contributive, or maybe we could call it in Christian terminology, agape love, identity principle, this view of happiness, where I become happy by making an optimal positive difference to the people around me, an optimal positive difference to the world around me. It's that realization, I don't want to get to 80 years old and go, what was the difference between the value of my life and that of a rock? And have to go, well, maybe the rock did more for the world than me. For all intents and purposes, that would be incipient unhappiness. So, of course, contribution is there. And ultimately, when they get into their 20s, they're going to want to make a difference to their families, a difference to their friends, even a difference to the culture around them, a difference to the kingdom of God, a difference to the society, a difference to their organization, a difference to the communities in which they live. They're going to want to make an optimal positive difference to the people that they touch. They're going to grow up. And when they grow up, they're going to notice that contributive level of happiness. And if they don't have it, I can assure you that the emptiness will be acute. And it is killing our culture. It is acute. And there's emptiness everywhere present. So the first way out of misery, the first way out of a self-imposed unhappiness, is start making a difference to the people around you. But there's yet something more important and even more pervasive. And that, of course, is faith. That is to say, living for God, living for one's salvation, living to be obedient to Jesus Christ, our Lord, he is the way, he is the truth, he is the life. Of course we need apologetics to back this up. You just can't tell a kid, have faith. Believe me, you're going to get pushed back beyond belief because you're going to ask a million questions. Do you have any evidence for God? Well, as a matter of fact, we do. And do you have any evidence for God from science? Isn't science opposed to faith? No, science is not opposed to faith. In fact, there's lots of evidence for God from science. And how would you find out about that? Why, you'd go to MontaCenter.com. And then you'd click on a big, you could even go faster. You could go to CredibleCatholic.com. Go to CredibleCatholic.com, click on the big red button that says 7 Essential Modules. And in that 7 Essential Modules, you go to Modules 1, 2, 3, and 4. Proof, 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 proof. Evidence from physics for God. Evidence from near-death experiences for the soul. Evidence from terminal lucidity for the soul. Evidence from space-time geometry proofs for God, an intelligent creator. Evidence from fine-tuning of the universal constants. I point to an intelligent creator. Evidence for the resurrection of Jesus on the Shroud of Turin. Come to my talk on Sunday and you'll get it in spades. You want to know the evidence for the resurrection? Right? I mean, scientifically validated evidence for the resurrection right on that impressive, most scientifically investigated relic in the history. And by the way, that 1988 carbon dating has been debunked, and I'll talk about that tomorrow. I mean, on Sunday. But the point I'm trying to get to is there's evidence, and the kids listen. They're all over it. I mean, and frankly, if you go to number five, there's a whole section on contemporary scientifically validated miracles that stem quite literally from, you know, the Lourdes Medical Commission to Our Lady of Guadalupe, even onto the, you know, Eucharistic miracle of Pope Francis that took place in, I believe it was 1998 in Buenos Aires, overseen by Archbishop Bergoglio at that time. So the main thing that's key in this whole area is that you give them evidence. Give them those seven essential modules. I'm just begging you. If you've got some kids in your high school class, in your family, your grandkids, whatever it is, don't leave them at level three. Get them to level four. Make them, I know it's seven 90-minute modules, but if you just did one module a week for Lent and just made it their Lenten obligation, and just sort of said, you'll like this. They will like it. It's really going to be the best boost of their faith from a scientific point of view that they can have. Enough of that advertisement, but it's important because it gets you up to level four. They then have the intellectual freedom to move to level four. And once they're at level four, we have all the techniques we need to teach them first how to pray and then how to begin a life of religious practice, how to do that. Because once you validated the church through miracles, once you validated the resurrection of Jesus through historical evidence and the scientific evidence on the show, once you validated all these, the evidence for God from contemporary physics and cosmology and a transcendent soul, etc., all of a sudden, it's no longer significant to live for this life alone. Why would you? If God exists, if you have a transphysical soul that's going to survive bodily death, that's been verified by 81% of blind people who see for the first time when they're clinically dead, are you kidding me? I mean, why would you live for this life alone? Why would you live for any half-baked reason? Why wouldn't you live for the fulfillment of your transcendental desires, for perfect truth and perfect love? That's the only thing that'll satisfy us. Perfect goodness, perfect beauty. Perfect being or home. That's what we seek. That's the only thing that'll satisfy us. As St. Augustine said in his prayer at the beginning of the Confessions to the Lord, for thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. And of course, we want to bring them up to that level where they can be filled by the religious practice. Filled, I mean, the sacrament of reconciliation is just so important for getting our lives turned around, so important for maintaining a good moral life. The Holy Eucharist is so important for being in communion with God. It utterly transformed my life. When I was in college, I started going to daily mass. People would tell me, Spencer, you're changing. I'd say, no, I'm the same utilitarian, you know, rat that I always was. And they go, no, you're really not. You really are changing. And of course, you know, when I started looking at this, in myself, I thought, oh my gosh, and look at what happened to me. So I mean, you know, the point is pretty clear. These are powerful sacraments, and if they could just see this and get testimonies of how this just links us to the way, the truth, and the life in Jesus Christ that's interpreted through our church, and we just take those six reasons for why be a Catholic, and we just keep on bringing that, you know, those truths to our kids, and then at the end of the day, we might have a fighting chance of keeping them not only on level three, but most importantly on level four, right unto their eternal salvation. That's where we want them. But let's get to the critical point here about the pro-life movement. We got to make a transition. If we could just go to that comparison game for a second. We're going to have to make the transition from dominant level one and two to dominant level three and four. In other words, these identity fulcrums, these definitions of happiness, they become like identity fulcrums for us, right? They become our purpose in life. One or two of them is going to become dominant. In our culture, levels one and two are dominant in our kids. At the age of 16, they are dominant level one and two. About 70% or more are dominant level one and two from the get-go. This is a problem. They're never going to get a pro-life argument. They're just not going to get it until they get up to the contributive level, level number three, or the transcendent level, faith level, which is level number four, or both three and four. We got to help them. They're already intransigently in level one and two. We've got to get them up to level three and four. If we do this, I swear we will change their hearts. If we change their hearts, we're going to change their minds about the pro-life movement. So I'm just going to quickly tell you, we have a method for doing this. And what we do is we get into these terrible problems of what's called the comparison game. Now, a comparison game is a really bad, bad deal in our culture. But it is also the key to getting kids to move out of the comparison game, because they're in misery. So what happens when we make ego comparative advantage? What happens when we make level two our dominant view of happiness? Who's achieving more? Who's achieving less? Who's got more power? Who's got less power? Who's smarter? Who's less smart? Who's more athletic? Certainly not me. Who's less athletic? Who is more beautiful? Who's less beautiful? Who's more status? Who's got less status? Who's more popular? Who's less popular? Who's winning? Who's losing? So if this is the primary focus of our kids, they're never going to see beyond their nose. They're never going to be able to see the pro-life argument. They're never going to be able to understand the seven principles I'm going to be talking about momentarily. So our point, of real importance is get them over the hump. How do you do that? Real simple. Point out the misery you know that they are feeling. Point out the misery. What's the misery? Let's go through the comparison game really quickly. The comparison game, if I'm asking questions, right, these are the focus questions for my identity. This is what's really mattering to me. Who's got more power? Who's got less power? Who's got more status? Less status? Who's more popular? Who's less popular? And you're just asking it neurotically, right? Of course, if that's where you are, just watch what happens. If you consider yourself to be a loser, I don't have to tell you, you are going to be depressed. And not only are you going to be depressed, you're going to be filled with jealousy. And you're going to try to undermine everyone else who seems to be a winner. And so, and you're going to be feelings of inferiority, feelings of being judged. This is not a happy existence. I mean, if the only thing that really matters in life is being a winner, the only thing that matters in life is being, more powerful, more status, more popularity, more intelligence, more athleticism. If that's the only thing that matters, I mean, look at the college scandals. If that's what really matters, don't lose. Don't lose. But what about winning? Maybe you could really get away with it if you were winning. And I just go right through the entire, gamut of these emotions. See, even the winner goes through these terrible, debilitating emotions because there's going to be somebody that is better than they are. There's always going to be some, a plateau that they cannot climb. There's always going to be that sense of not being able to progress forever. And then you get that wonderful experience of being an arrogant, narcissistic kind of rat. And people don't like arrogant, narcissistic rats. People don't like people who are holding them in contempt. Augustine said so sagely, "The contemptuous man is truly lonely indeed." And that's true. People are poised for flight around people who think of themselves as totally arrogant, as totally, above it all. And at the same time, they resent you for being poised for flight. Why didn't you come and adore me, treat me like God, give me the adulation I deserve, you little inferior being you? Who do you think you are, not praising me today and giving me my adulation? I know what I'll do. I'll teach you a lesson. I'll put you down. And in every way I can, I'll try to undermine your hope because I resent you and I'm angry. I really am. Been there, done that. The point I'm trying to get to is, it's real. But this is what Hegel would call the unhappy consciousness, right? Listen, you're not a happy person. This is what St. Augustine would say. This is pure misery. Don't like it. Augustine was a really smart guy. He was right up at the top of his game. But he was empty beyond belief. That's the first problem of the winner. They're empty even at the top of their game. And number two, they're resentful and lonely because they're very egotistical. And number three, they're always worried Always worried about being exposed. Always worried about people finding out they really aren't God. They really aren't the top. They really have perpetuated a sort of a quasi-fraud. Even if they are really smart, they've always kind of pushed it too hard because it meant too much. You get the point. As I'm describing these things, and by the way, whatever you do, don't stay in the middle. Then you're going to be swept up between, you know, you're literally going to feel like you just got into the vibrator, right? Inferiority one moment, superiority and contempt the next moment, resentment one moment, and then, you know, being judged the next moment. And then on top of it all, fear of failure, fear of loss of esteem, fear of being exposed. Great, wonderful. This is the life you really want. Zooming from self-pity on the one hand to, you know, absolute, you know, resentment on the other. Ego rage, ego blame. As I'm describing these emotions, you know, to the kids, oh, do not think for a moment they do not know what I am talking about. They know exactly what I am talking about. As we play those videos, those kids know exactly what we're talking about. And so, of course, you know, they are thinking to themselves, how do I get out of this? This is me. How can I stop it? The winner, loser, drawer. Nobody wins the comparison game. Nobody wins by making level 2 ego comparative identity dominant. No one wins. It's a pure misery, and layered over it all is pure emptiness. Day one out. Go to the next slide. The way out. We've got several ways out. I'm just going to talk very briefly about two techniques. When they start practicing these techniques, you've already changed their hearts. They're primed to get the principles. Now, I know there's 4 techniques on here, but I don't have time for 4. So we're going to do the first 2. The first thing you need to do for the kids is to get them to describe what we might call a self-manifestation, or, you know, what is frequently called a manifesto. I manifest, right? What is it that I declare about myself? So we want them to do basically... I'm sorry? Oh, we want them to do basically, a contributive list, right? So we want them to start asking, you know, okay, how can I make an optimal positive difference to my family? Now that, you know, maybe only one thing will come to mind or no things will come to mind yet. But they're asking the question. The second thing, how do I make an optimal positive difference to my friends? Maybe they're not going to say anything yet. Maybe they just can't think of anything yet. But they're asking the question, and that makes all the difference. How can I make an optimal positive difference to my school, you know, my institution? Or if I'm already employed, my organization, my employees. How can I make an optimal positive? And they, again, they might say, well, I don't know anything now. You know, just keep asking the question. Don't have to answer it now. Just keep asking the question, because answers are going to start occurring to you at 2 o'clock in the morning someday. And when they do, write them down. How do I make an optimal positive difference to my community around me? Do I want to do something for somebody beyond myself, whether it's in the Little League or whatever it may be? How do I make an optimal positive difference to my community? How do I want to make an optimal positive difference ultimately to the kingdom of God? How do I want to make an optimal positive difference to the church? I mean, we're talking about eternity here. And every human being, if you look at those near-death experiences and those studies of terminal lucidity and NDEs, I mean, I don't think you're going to have a doubt in the world. The kids don't have a doubt in the world that they have a transphysical soul that's going to survive bodily death. We may as well admit we're all little eternities. And boy, everything we can do to help people get into that eternity, into that salvation, particularly through Jesus Christ as interpreted by the church, is the best thing we could ever do for them. What are we going to do? I know you might not be able to answer the question right now. Don't have to answer the question. Just keep thinking of the question. Just keep rolling on this, baby. And then at the end of asking all these questions, you know, maybe you can ask a question, what can I do for the culture and the society? And of course, kids can't think, you know, culture, society. I'm in high school here. I got to think about college, you know. That's okay. Just keep the question going. Because at some point, things will occur to you, and this list of questions will be your liberation. And at the end of that list of questions, there's this wonderful little phrase. Just keep saying it to yourself. For this I came. For this I came. This is why I am here, to make this optimal contribution to family, to friends, to church, to society, to the kingdom of God, to the community, to my school, to the institution, etc. For this I came. The minute you start believing that, what happens to those emotions of the comparison game we saw in the last slide? They're just knocked right off their rocker. They're just gonna. And they decrease precipitously. And that's really key. And so right there, these kids are beginning to see, my gosh, you know, if I'm living for a contributor, this is what I'm supposed to. Of course all those kids have the noble ideals built into them. For thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they resonate. We're created by God to seek the contributive. And then, once we've got them there, the second thing to do is to get them to look at one another by looking for the good news. If they can just empathize. But empathy requires, so we're going to the second technique here, empathy requires that we look for the good news in the other. But you probably noticed this yourself. When you're looking for the good news in somebody, the bad news gets contextualized. Unfortunately, when you're looking for the bad news in somebody, the good news simply gets eclipsed. So you can't look for the good news and the bad news. You really got to focus on the good news. It's a real discipline, and the reason is that the bad news is our default drive. Why would the bad news be our default drive? Well, aside from original sin, the real reason is that it rivets us to itself. What's weak, stupid, unkind, unfair, irritating, really just rivets us to itself. If you ever tried it out, go home tonight, well, look at your spouse or look at your friend and just let your default drive have a field day. Start looking for the irritating, weak, stupid, unkind, and unfair. And just ask yourself, is there any empathy for this person whatsoever in my life? What do I think of that person? Are they a problem or are they a mystery? That they're a problem. The point I'm trying to get to is, you're not going to get to empathy. If you don't get to empathy, you can't get to love. So we teach the kids how to look for the good news in the other, how to make this a habitual practice. Because if you can do this, then empathy comes back into the fore. But it's a discipline. The bad news is riveting us. We've got to act against it. We know in our hearts that the good news is the reality of the people around us. For the kids, it's the reality of their parents, the reality of their brothers and sisters. Don't worry. They know that there's good news there. They don't want to acknowledge it, you know, some of the time. But they know that it's there, and of course they can live for it. So that's our point. We want to get them there. And finally, of course, we want to get them to that transcendent realm. We want to get the evidence for God presented to them. We want to get them to make a faith, a direct faith proclamation in God, in Jesus Christ, in the soul that they have, and even in the church. If we can get them to make a faith proclamation and just write it down, you know, this, I believe this, this is what makes my life ultimately worth living. If we can get them to make a faith proclamation, start a prayer life, and commit to religious practice by going to church and by going to the sacrament of reconciliation on some regular basis. Don't have to ask for the world, but just ask for those three things. Go to church, go to the sacrament of reconciliation, start some spontaneous prayers. We have a whole list of spontaneous prayers for them. If we can get them to that point, you've got them right where you want them. And you go, well, wait a minute, when are we going to talk about the pro-life movement? We have been talking about the pro-life movement. Because, of course, love, that agape love, which Jesus teaches us in the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount, that is, right, faith in God is so much a part of the changing of the heart. You've got to cultivate the soil first. You've got to cultivate the receptivity of the heart. Because if you do, then these principles that I'm now going to give you are going to be like easy peasy. I mean, they really will come to, they'll know the truth of them. These are principles of the heart, basically, but they really look like they're principles of the mind. But deep down, when you're talking about them, they really involve the heart because they're ethical principles. These are not logical principles. Logical principles are principles of the mind. That's a great thing. Study logic. Study mathematics. I love mathematics. I'm a good numbers guy. Always liked it. You know, always, you know, produce good rational arguments. That's all in the mind. And these are good rational arguments that I'm going to be giving you. But remember, because they're ethical, they involve the heart. So we do our first step. Now let's go to our second step. Now we've got to give them all the underlying principles in a short amount of time. We're going to have to give them the underlying principles of what we might call social ethics. But if you give them these underlying principles and then you bring up the pro-life issues, nailed them. Because there's no way you can embrace these seven principles and turn right around and be pro-abortion. You cannot do it. It's a violation of all seven of them. Let's take a look at what's going on. What are the seven principles? I always start by talking about slavery first, because the most gross violation besides Roe versus Wade of these seven principles, universal principles, the most gross violation was the Dred Scott decision, right? Dred Scott versus Sanford, where, of course, the Supreme Court of the United States unanimously said that black people should be subordinated to white people, that black people had no rights under the Constitution, never even mentioned the natural rights, the inalienable rights of black people, just completely wrote them off, and then turned around and said in their last great proclamation of the decision, therefore, in light of all of this, the Negro should be subjugated to the superior race. It came out of the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, you got to look at that and you got to say, this doesn't sound right. And it isn't right. It's terrible. But how did they get there? The same way that the justices, the majority in the Roe v. Wade decision, got to their decision. And let's talk about it right now. Principle number one. Principle number one comes from St. Augustine. And this, by the way, has been writ large in every single solitary doctrine that has been talked about. In probably every social reformer, from Martin Luther King to Mahatma Gandhi, not Christian at all, although it came from a Christian, it originated with a Christian and a Catholic, St. Augustine, it still has been embraced by every single solitary social reformer. An unjust law is no law at all. Now, when Augustine uttered this, he knew exactly what he was saying. What he was saying is, justice is higher than the positive law. What's a positive law? A positive law is a man-made law, a human-made law. It is a law which is passed by a legislature, a law in a constitution, a law that is implicit in a judicial decision, a law that comes from a vote or a plebiscite. It's a law made by human hands, the positive law. But what Augustine says is, no, justice is higher than the positive law, the principle of justice. And the principle of justice has two component parts. And what Augustine wants to say is justice, every human being deserves justice. And justice under the law. So he's saying justice, the principle of justice, is higher than the positive law. And the positive law must be subservient to and serving the principle of justice. We're going to talk about the principle of justice, and it involves the principle of non-maleficence, which I'm going to be discussing in a minute, and it involves the principle of equity. But every human being deserves justice, and justice specifically under the law. And that's why if a positive law is contrary to the principle of non-maleficence, if a positive law is contrary to the principle of equity, then that is no law at all. It never lives up to what a law is supposed to do. Namely, protect justice for everyone. That's the point. Let's go to our second slide here. So how do we talk about justice? And the next five principles actually do define what justice is. The most fundamental principle is the principle of non-maleficence. And that's a fancy way of saying, right, you can see non-male there, right? No evil to someone, no harm to someone. So we basically call the principle of non-maleficence the silver rule. And that is juxtaposed to the golden rule. The silver rule, as we'll see in a moment, is ethical minimalism. It's the basic, hard foundation bedrock of ethics. If you deny the silver rule, the entirety of ethics will collapse. The entirety of justice will collapse. So what do we need then? What's the silver rule? What does it mean? Do not, remember the silver rule has the knots in it. Do not do unto others what you would not have them do unto you. What does that mean? Don't do a harm to others you don't want done to you. Well, I'm sorry? Don't do a harm to others that you do not want done to you. So what we want to do then is we want to get underneath it. Avoid unnecessary harms to others. If a harm is unavoidable, then minimize it. So we want to avoid unnecessary harms. And I always say to the kids, right, now, if you can't validate this principle as really essential for your ethical lives, you're a sociopath. Just admit it right now. If you think in order to be happy that you have to cause unnecessary harm to others, you're a sociopath. And by the way, if you have a friend who walks up to you and says, I really think I need to do harm to others in order to be happy, unnecessary harms to others in order to be happy, run, Bambi, run. Because that friend is a sociopath, and he will eventually harm you. So what's my point? Of course people are going to self-validate this. The kids don't have a problem with saying we ought to avoid unnecessary harms to others, and if a harm is unavoidable, to minimize it. We just don't. How do we apply it to the pro-life movement? Now, normally I talk about this with slavery first, and then I get into the pro-life principle. But right now, just jump to the pro-life principle. Clearly, you can see that abortion is an unnecessary harm. Now, of course, a lot of people will say, wait a minute. It all depends on what you mean by necessary. I mean, I think abortion is necessary because it avoids, you know, young people bringing a quote-unquote unwanted life into the world. Well, if you look around at the adoption agencies, they're terribly short of children. We're going everywhere in the world to find children to bring to people for adoption. Don't say unwanted. I mean, it's not a universal command. The point is, of course, people are going to say, well, it saves a lot of embarrassment. You know, well, embarrassment, do you think that really justifies killing your baby internally? And by the way, there is plenty of scientific evidence, right, that a single-celled zygote is human. It is a living human being. And therefore, we should treat a single-celled zygote like a living human being. It has a full human DNA package. It's a unique human. There's no other being like that. There's no other human being like that in the world or in history. It's a unique DNA package. It has mitochondrial DNA, which belongs only to human beings. It's human. It's uniquely human. And all of the genetic information necessary to transform that little single-celled zygote into a full-on human being is already present in that metabolizing and dividing cell. Implanted or not implanted. My point is there's no excuse for killing a human being to prevent embarrassment. We would never allow this under any other circumstance in the law. I mean, can you imagine saying, well, why did you kill that person the other day? Well, he was about to reveal some embarrassing details to me. And I thought, well, it's necessary to kill him because my embarrassment is much worse than his death. So I just made a judgment call and killed him. No one would, you know, you'd look at that, are you out of your mind? You're a sociopath, of course. I mean, this is what are we talking about here? Enough said. Let's just go to the second principle. But remember, the principle of non-maleficence, the silver rule, that's really, really basic. You can't let it fall. But then the church kind of got into this important thing, too, of the end does not justify the means. Again, this comes from St. Augustine, the great, great, brilliant St. Augustine. And what he wanted to tell us is you can't use an evil means to get to a good end. Now, this is a complicated principle to apply, and you do have to have some nuance. But essentially, here's the basic principle. The end alone does not determine whether an act is moral. The objective that you're trying to reach does not justify any means to getting there. The means has to be justifiable in itself. Therefore, you have to know that the means is good, that is to say, the way of getting to the end, and the end is good. So you want the end to be good and the means to be good. Now, we have principles that tell us which means are good and which means are not good. And, of course, we don't want to be using an evil means to get to a good end. Now, you might say, well, give me an example of that. And you just say, okay, I have a good end. I want to contribute $5 million to a whole lot of charities, the Majus Center, Gonzaga University, the Los Angeles Congress, and so forth, and the Sacred Heart Hospital. I just got a million great causes, $2 million. I could do a lot of good with $2 million. Now, my way of getting $2 million in a hurry is we're all going to take an insurance policy out on Spitzer, and we're going to get a $2 million one, and then we're going to invite him to a nice banquet, and all we have to do is just slip a little hemlock right on into that last steak and take care of the matter succinctly. And if we kill Spitzer and we defraud the insurance company, then we get the $2 million, which will do all of this good for Gonzaga and for Sacred Heart Hospital and all these other things. And you go, something's wrong with that. Yes, something's wrong with it, as Augustine was wont to say. The evil of the means simply undermines and eliminates the goodness of the end. You got to have consistency then between the means and the end. Now, we know there is the famous exception. What happens when you're trying to prevent an evil? You're not just doing a good, you're trying to prevent an evil. There's two things we just have to remember. Yes, the church does say, for example, that self-defense or a just war is permissible. Well, how come you're killing a person? How come that's permissible? The first thing is you have to have you have to be preventing a greater evil from occurring than the means that you're using. So that's the first thing. You have to have an equivalent or greater evil that's being prevented. But that's not enough. No one can ever intend evil. So what you have to be intending, even if you're in a war, your intention is not to kill that person. Your intention is to liberate a country that is being persecuted. And right now, your intention is self-defense. Not to murder, not to kill a person, but to defend yourself in the project of liberating. And so this is called the principle of double effect. Now, I'm not going to get into the principle of double effect in too much detail today, but I'll just give one example. And there are many examples of this in this book, 10 Universal Principles. And in that little article that I told you about, that you just Susan at MajaCenter.com, and you can get some more examples. But the key point here's just one example. Suppose you're in a hospital, and suppose that you are getting morphine. The morphine is being given to you because you have a terminal illness and it's extraordinarily painful, and the morphine is the only way to do that. Despite the fact that morphine has a very high therapeutic index, that is to say, you could maintain consciousness with a great deal of morphine in you, and you could still have very lucid moments and so forth, the fact is you put enough morphine into somebody and it's going to kill them because it'll stop respiration. Now, what's the point? The point is, when you're administering morphine, you're giving the morphine to the person to prevent them from being in agonizing pain, not to kill them. So you can't then look up at the nurse and go, give me a little bit more of that morphine, enough to, tip me over the edge here. I'm good. You can't do that. That's suicide. And if a doctor did it without your permission, it'd be murder. You shouldn't do it. Nevertheless, if I was giving you the morphine and that morphine was being administered and suddenly your breathing stopped because I was trying to keep you comfortable, not trying to kill you, the church would say that abides by the principle of double effect. It's okay. There's a second effect, a good effect, and the good effect outweighs the bad effect in our intentions, what we intend to do. So that intention is really, really important. So when we teach, the end does not justify the means, you do have to teach that caveat about, you're preventing a greater evil means, but you cannot intend the evil. You have to use the principle of double effect. Enough said. That's the most complicated of the principles. Let's get to the next principle. Now, this is the fourth principle, and it's a principle of personhood. And there's two elements to this. And by the way, it was brought to bear, again, the slavery issue always comes up in conjunction with this, right? And that is Bartolomé de las Casas, who was a fine Dominican, I hate to say, I'm just kidding, a fine Dominican priest. But Bartolomé de las Casas was a lawyer before he became a missionary and a bishop to the Indians in the New World. And in 1560, he was basically summoned back to Spain for a debate with Juan Luis de Sepulveda. And Sepulveda basically held this. Listen to this statement. The Indians are not fully human beings. The Indians are not fully persons. Why, said Sepulveda, what's his justification for this? He says, well, that's because the Indians are not as advanced in culture as we are. not as advanced in mathematics, not as advanced in music, not as advanced in architectural, you know, feats and so forth and so on. You can just see they are just light years behind. Therefore, they're not fully human. They're not full persons. They're sub-persons. Have we not heard this before in history? I don't have to say it. It's there in, of course, not just the Nazi regime, but boy, certainly that. But it was certainly there too when the Maoist, cut back on the population, was certainly there in, Stalin's complete annihilation of half of the population of the Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. Every time you see somebody relegated to a subhuman, you got trouble. Now, let's just take a look at it from the slavery point of view. Here's what Las Casas responds to Sepulveda. He says, you're entirely wrong. You have given no proof that the Indian peoples are any more subhuman than we are. And why is that? Because the Indian peoples are already learning our mathematics and will learn it twice as fast as anybody has presented it. They've already learned our architectural techniques and they're learning it twice as fast as anybody in Europe ever did it. They're already composing their own music, making their own musical instruments. They've already organized into these huge communes and they already have these huge collective farms with irrigation and everything else. What are you talking about? In 10 years, they'll be just like you. Are you kidding me? They deserve to be, and here's the principle, they deserve to be judged, their humanity deserves to be judged on their full potential, not on any particular actualization in a point of time. Where the Indians were during the debate in that particular argument, it probably was true. They were not at the same level as Europeans at that moment. But what Las Casas says is that's a mere historical accident where they are at any given time. What really matters is what will they become in time? Just like you. Who are you to say that they're not fully human? I think Las Casas won this debate. And by the way, if you go to the article, there's a wonderful book that's been translated into English, you know, on this whole area, against the bloodthirsty tactics of the conquistadores in favor of the Indian peoples. It's a great title. But anyway, the point I'm trying to get to is you get the principle. Does it apply to the pro-life movement? Absolutely. Notice what the Supreme Court's wording is in Roe versus Wade. They're not persons, or at least the Supreme Court said, we don't know whether they're persons or not, so let's assume that they're not persons. Bad on two levels. Bad on the level of, we don't know whether they're persons, they're full human beings. And they should be judged not on the state of development of the embryo at this moment. They deserve, as Las Casas said, to be judged on the humanity that they have according to their full potential. Full potential is the only thing that matters. And said, Las Casas, to top off the matter, if you do not habituate yourself to this principle, if you don't judge those Indians on the basis of their full potential, you are going to grossly violate the principle of non-maleficence, and you're going to send the entire ethical system of Europe tottering. The Indians will be morally superior to you in months. But unfortunately, the Spanish court did not rule in favor of Las Casas. They did later, but they didn't at the time, and poor Las Casas died still trying to fight, these terrible atrocities. But my point is simply this. We must teach the kids. Never, ever, ever judge the humanity or personhood of a human being on the basis of any particular actualization at any particular point in time. Every human being must be judged according to full potential. By the way, there were so many slaves who wrote about this during the Civil War period who were very articulate, demanding that they be judged according to their full potential. These slaves were extremely well educated. And they were extremely banded together. I mean, they put together, the Underground Railroad. They put together so many different tractates on this. And it's just marvelous to behold the literature. And if you wanted to get that whole article, just send an email to susan@magicenter.com and you can get all those wonderful authors. My point, though, is now we get to the crescendo, the next principle of inalienable rights. Because if you buy into the principle of non-maleficence, and the kids do, if you buy into the principle of that caveat, right, the end doesn't justify the means, you got to make sure that you're not committing evil and the means are the ends, right? And if you're trying to prevent a greater evil by using an evil means, you cannot intend it. You must intend the good that comes from it, the prevention of that evil. The third thing, of course, is the whole area of person. If you buy those three principles, you are sucked into inalienable rights. There's no getting you out of it. And you might wonder, well, where did the principle of inalienable rights come from anyway? A Jesuit, I'm glad to say. Francisco Suarez. Exactly. In 1612, he writes this tractate called De Legibus. And on the laws. And in that tractate, which John Finnis, the great scholar of natural law at Oxford, calls the watershed of natural rights, the watershed of inalienable rights, Suarez makes the case for inalienable rights, rights that belong to a human being by their very nature. Let's go back to St. Augustine. An unjust law is no law at all. Every single human being deserves justice. And the way that Suarez tries to justify this is he says, you've got a soul. And there's more evidence for the soul today than you can possibly imagine, not just from the existence of our five transcendental desires for perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home, but certainly from these near-death experiences, scientific studies and near-death experiences, terminal lucidity, creativity, the Gödel's theorem and mathematics, conceptual ideas. I mean, there's so much evidence for a transcendent soul. It just knocks your block off. If you believe for a single second that you are somehow equatable with animals and that you are a mere aggregate of molecules and atoms, you are so wrong by scientific definition. I will challenge anyone, any physicalist, to any debate at any time. I've debated this at Berkeley. I've been up there talking about it. There's just no question in my mind. There's plenty of evidence. We've got a soul. And says Suarez, if you have that creative soul, if you have the desire for perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and being, then you by your nature deserve to live. And your creator intended it so. But you don't have to bring up creator. You don't have to use a God argument. Just say, you deserve to live. You have an inalienable right to life by definition. Justice demands that you have a right to life. And then Suarez goes on to say, you have a right to self-governance. That's kind of the word he used for liberty, but it's the same thing, freedom, but it really means you have the right to govern yourself. You have the right to custody over the thoughts in your mind, the beliefs in your heart, the ideals you seek, the religion you practice. You have a right to all of that self-governance and to give that away to your children as well, who are part and parcel of your family and your being. Justice demands the right to self-governance. And you have the right to pursue happiness. You have the right to pursue greater fulfillment in your life. That's why you have a soul that desires perfect truth. It's seeking fulfillment. That's why you have a desire for perfect love, seeking fulfillment, seeking happiness. That's why you have a desire for perfect goodness or justice, seeking fulfillment. That's why you have a desire for perfect beauty and perfect home, seeking fulfillment. All these things are really important. He says, of course you have a desire, a right to pursue happiness. You have a right to fulfill the very powers of your soul that you have been created with, whether you believe that God created you or not. Justice demands that you have a right to fulfill what belongs to you intrinsically by your very nature. And finally, you have a right to property. You have a right to own property. Why? Because if everybody owns everything around you, then you become an indentured servant to the property owner. That's why serfdom wasn't true freedom. You had to break out of serfdom so that people could own something on their own, so that they could therefore have use and usufruct in order to pursue happiness and self-government. They could have use and usufruct of their own property and would not be subjected to another property owner. Now, these four rights, which, by the way, Suarez really defends them, and if you want the Suarez quotes, go right to 10 Universal Principles, or Susan@modjacenter.com and get your free article. Same thing. What's my point? My point is, once this is off the ground, then every human being has inalienable rights. Every human being is deserving, right? Of justice under law. Every human being has intrinsic to their being those rights to exist, to self-govern, to pursue those five transcendental desires and to have the sufficient property to govern them. Even a single-celled zygote. I don't care whether it's implanted, not implanted. Of course it's in the womb, et cetera, et cetera. I don't care whether it's dependent on the mother. They have an inalienable right. What's an inalienable right? One that belongs to you by your very human existence. One that belongs to you by your very human nature. That's what is an inalienable right. The kids get it. They go, yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to say that every human being, yeah, who's the human being? What are you going to say? That the fetus is not human because it's not fully developed? You can't say that because that violates Las Casas' principle of full potential, judging the human being according to full potential. I mean, what are you going to say? It's not doing harm to kill him? I mean, it violates the right to life. What are you talking about? The point, of course, is, I mean, it's almost airtight. You're sucked in. Once you accord inalienable rights to a single-celled zygote, let alone a fetus, let alone, you know, a nine-month-old embryo who's just proceeding out of the womb, and you get this New York law that's absolutely nutso. I mean, the key thing, of course, is once you acknowledge this, then you don't have a right to govern, to kill anybody. Now, there's an important distinction between intrinsic rights and extrinsic rights. Intrinsic rights belong to people by their very nature. We call them natural rights. Extrinsic rights are ones that are given to you because of a constitution or something of that nature. Now, of course, what happens? An extrinsic right, you know, for example, we have a Bill of Rights in our Constitution, the right to religious liberty, the right to free speech, etc. We have these rights that are, mapped out for us, but they're extrinsic rights. They're given by a governmental system. What Suarez says and insists on is no government has given you your natural rights. You own your own natural rights by the very fact that you are a human existent. You own your own human rights by the fact that you have the desires for perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home. You have your own human rights, if I can put it this way, because you have a soul that's destined for God. You have your own. It belongs to you. No government gave them to you, and no government can take them away. Now, Hugo Grotius, the father of international law, about 12 or maybe 15 years after Suarez writes this, he's reading Suarez, and he goes, oh, this is it. This is the way to avoid a tyranny of the majority. He sees the problem with a vote is that 51% of the people can take away the rights of the other 49% of the people. 51% of the people could say, well, I think we got to kill Spitzer, and that's it. There's no protection for Spitzer. But there is protection for Spitzer because I am deserving of justice. I am a human being with the desires of perfect truth, love, goodness, beauty, and home. Whether I can manifest those desires or not, I must assume that they're there as a human being, that I have that soul. And if I do make such an assumption, then I have the inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Once Grotius spots that this is the prevention, right, that an unjust law is no law at all, once he decides that there cannot be a violation of the rights of human beings, that every government is responsible for these rights first and foremost on the part of every human being in the society, no law can violate those natural rights. What's so interesting is that in Roe versus Wade, in Dred Scott decision, the Supreme Court forgot about natural rights. They forgot about intrinsic and inalienable rights. The only thing they looked for was extrinsic rights. It's absolutely stunning to look at what has happened. You know, our own founding fathers did not want inalienable rights to be mentioned in the Bill of Rights. You can imagine why they didn't. Because if they put them in the Bill of Rights, it would have sounded like some government was giving you the right to life and liberty and pursuit of happiness and property. But no government ever gave you those rights because they belong to you by your very nature. Let's not have any confusion. So where did the fathers put the inalienable rights of human beings if it wasn't in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights of the Constitution? Exactly, the Declaration of Independence. That's right, where he's, of course, Jefferson is declaring himself free from the governance of Britain. Why? Because of a violation of the rights of the citizens of the United States, the natural rights of the citizens. And he begins that great thing. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Self-evident! I don't have to justify it. You ought to know that every human being, by their very nature, has the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness and property. Otherwise, you're going to violate the principle of non-maleficence or violate the principle of their own personhood. You ought to know that. Self-evident. And not only that it's self-evident, but also that these individuals have the rights of life, the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. so that it's and that they're born equal to one another in those rights. So this is really important. I mean, it comes out in the Declaration, but it doesn't come out in the Bill of Rights. Yet, if you look at the Dred Scott decision, notice what the justices did. They ignored the inalienable rights of black people in the case of Dred Scott, and they ignored the inalienable rights of the human beings inside the womb, right, in the case of Roe versus Wade. They ignored it. They pretended like natural rights weren't there and shifted their focus right away, and surreptitiously, I might add, they shifted their focus just to the Constitution, just to extrinsic rights. Let's see whether black people have any constitutional rights, because that's the only way of seeing whether they have rights. Well, of course, they have the natural right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That's been literally ignored off the table, and now they go looking for the Constitution. Of course, the Constitution doesn't mention specifically the rights of black people. So not surprisingly, the justices declare, you know, in the most remarkable decision, well, it looks like because of the Constitution's silence, a violation of another legal principle. Silence is silence, ladies and gentlemen. If the Constitution is silent, it does not mean yes, and it does not mean no. This is lesson number one in the principles of evidence. You cannot interpret silence as yes or no. It could be either. So what's the point? They say because the Constitution is silent, we will say that there's no guarantee. Okay, that there is no guarantee, you know, of the rights of these human beings. I'm going to move it ahead a little bit, but you get the point of this, right? And the point is very clear. They've forgotten inalienable rights. They've misinterpreted what silence means, and then they purposely subjugated black people to what they call the superior race, white people. And in the Roe versus Wade decision, they did the very same thing. They ignored the natural rights, the inalienable rights of the human being. Then they basically said that the human beings had to justify their own human existence in order to have rights. Then they searched for the rights of human beings in the Constitution, constitutional precedents, and not finding a constitutional precedent, although there were plenty of legal precedents from Supreme Courts about the rights of unborn children, hereditary rights, rights to sue under the law, rights to sue on behalf of the mother, et cetera, et cetera. It's all there. But, of course, it wasn't a constitutional precedent. Therefore, finding none declares that silence means that the unborn child does not have any rights at all according to the Constitution. Dead wrong, deadly fallacious, deadly sophistical, deadly, period. And this is the false logic of the Supreme Court, violates clearly the inalienable rights of human beings, and just turns any evidentiary procedure on its head. It's just terrible. Let's go to the next thing, the hierarchy of rights. I have to do this really quickly. Here's the basic evolution. You know, you might say, how did they get to Jefferson? So Suarez writes about it, right, justifies it. Then the second thing is Hugo Grotius, the father of international law, copies it into his international law books. John Locke sees it and puts it into his second treatise on government. Then Thomas Jefferson reads both Grotius and Locke and puts it into the Declaration of Independence. Then the United Nations Charter goes ahead and puts it into the UN Charter for all human beings throughout the world, declaring the same inalienable rights argument for every human being, right? You get the point. I mean, it's now common practice. The secular world has, quote unquote, baptized, right, the Christian principle of inalienable rights, made it their own. So let's go to the next principle, the hierarchy of rights. Hierarchy of rights is really important. Now, when you see Suarez or John Locke or Thomas Jefferson articulate the inalienable rights, the normal order that they put it in is life first, then liberty or self-governance, and then property or the pursuit of happiness. So pursuit of happiness or property. In the case of John Locke, he only considered property. In the case of Thomas Jefferson, he only took pursuit of happiness. But basically, they're both there. Now, why this hierarchy? It's an objective hierarchy, and it was justified by Suarez and Locke both. And here's how the argument basically works according to the necessity criterion. Any right which is necessary for another right to exist must be the higher right. Why so? If the right to life is necessary for the very possibility of the right to liberty, in other words, you can't have a liberty right unless the right to life is already in play, right? Then the right to life has to be a higher right than the liberty right. Hey, if you're dead, your liberty rights are a moot question. The point is clear. It's the same thing with liberty and property. Listen, I mean, you have to have the right to liberty in order to have a right to property. If I get to say to you, hey, you can own all the property you want, but I get to own you. De facto, I own all your property too. Hello, your property rights are a moot question. So clearly, if one right is necessary for the other, then the right that's necessary for the other one has to be the higher right, and you have to judge any argument accordingly. Now, let's just get to the principle at hand, and that is, let's suppose you have an argument like what came before the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade. You have the argument that it's the right to life of the fetus versus the right to privacy, which is a liberty right, right? It's an extended liberty right. The right to privacy of a woman who wants, who's carrying the baby to term. And that's precisely the terms that the Supreme Court put it in. Now, when you really look at this for just a second, you can see, well, clearly the fetus's right to life by any objective necessity standard has to outweigh the woman's right to privacy. It just does because it's a higher right. Just like the Dred Scott decision saying that the black man's liberty rights are subordinate to the white man's property rights so he can own you and keep his cotton farm going. You kidding me? I mean, this is an objective necessity. Of course the black man's liberty rights have to be higher than the white man's property rights. And then they adjudicate the decision in favor of the lower right. It's exactly what happened in the Roe versus Wade decision. You want all the wording of the court? Just go right to 10 universal principles. Just go right to the free article. It's all there. What's my point? My point is this is a gross violation of any kind of objective procedure in the allocation or resolution of rights disputes. It's terribly wrong. I'm going to skip the last principle, which is the intrinsic limits to human freedom. It's a good principle. You can read about it in that article, Susan, at montjesenter.com. Just get it, and you can see it. Let me make the point now. Going back to those statistics for just a second. Those statistics, I mean, when you start applying these principles across the board to the life issues with the kids, you start with slavery. Always start with slavery. Then just say, well, let's see if these principles also apply to preborn human beings. Let's see if that works too. And then you start applying them right across the board. What begins to happen? What begins to dawn on them? Remember, you've done all the work of the heart first, and you got to do that. But if you've done your work of the heart, if you've got them up to level 3 and level 4, and they're open to what's going on with these principles, these are the principles of human civilization. They're the highest principles of social ethics and human civilization we have. You want to throw those out the window so we can have precious abortion? It's crazy. The point, of course, I'm trying to get to in my rather passionate way is that when the kids see this, they are literally floored, and it changes their minds. They do not want to be contradicting themselves. But more importantly, they do not want to be justifying the overthrow of the principles whose overthrow led to slavery. They don't want to be on the part of the slave trader side. They know there's something wrong with it. And so I just tell them, if you're going to throw out these principles for the pro-life movement, you've got to throw them out with respect to slavery. Join, you know, the ranks of the Dred Scott decision. And they don't want to do it. They know in their heart of hearts that the principles are right. They know that slavery is wrong. They know that a zygote is a full, unique human being with the full potential to be a contributing, wonderful citizen, right, etc. And so for all intents and purposes, then, what we want to do is bring them to that matter. Going back to the statistics, 51% were pro-life. That means 49% were pro-abortion. And what we did was we changed them from 51% pro-life to 86% pro-life. We made a 71% transition by first getting to the heart of the matter and then going to the principles of the mind, the principles of civilization. And so by doing this, we would actually get ourselves to the point of a real case, not only for pro-life, but the restoration of our inalienable rights, the restoration of full human personhood judged according to full potential, the restoration of the principle of non-maleficence, the restoration of the principle of justice. And so we could finally say in conscience, an unjust law is no law at all. and this is an unjust law, and they'll say, prove it, and I'll get right out to those five principles. It violates the principle of non-maleficence. It violates the principle of the end not justifying the means. It violates the principle of personhood judged according to full human potential. It violates the principle of inalienable rights. It violates the hierarchy of rights, and it violates the intrinsic limits of human freedom. It's just so unjust, it reeks injustice. According to our own principles, baptized by our own culture. I give you these five free resources again. Some of them free, some of them not free. Just go to susan@magicenter.com. There's a free article. Number two, just go to this book, 10 Universal Principles, for the second half of my talk. Go to this book, Healing the Culture, if you're interested in the four levels of happiness and how that affects the whole dialogue, the transition from level one and two to level three and four. Then if you really want a high school curriculum about this, go to either healingtheculture.com or principlesandchoices.com. And I'm telling you, there's resources there. We can change the world. Yes, of course, we have to be political. Yes, of course, we have to be marching and protesting and doing all kinds of things, the March for Life and beyond. Of course, we have to be using our best wits to try and get to a point where we can reverse the insanity of infanticide that has now become real in our culture and justified by fiat of legislation in our culture. Yes, we have to do all those things, but we have to educate besides. And here's the bedrock, a bedrock of principles that was created by Catholic geniuses and that got baptized into the world of the secular world, of a culture that calls itself free and a culture that protects the inalienable rights of humankind. If we can do that, we can rescue this culture. We can rescue our young people from a kind of terrible fatalism into what St. John Paul II called a culture of death. We can rescue so many innocent human lives from this degradation that they are being subjected to. Education will do the trick. You are our educators. I beg of you, please bring these principles into your classroom in any way that you can. Thank you so very, very much for your kind attention. Thank you.